From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
The judges are now inviting Illinois Republicans and a Latino legal group to propose their own districts. Both of those groups sued the state over the new districts passed by Democrats. Republicans claim Democrats gerrymandered the districts to keep their hold on power in Springfield. And the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund claims the new districts don't account for the population growth of Latinos.
If this change was indeed made to ruthlessly entrench a Democratic district, I fear that even that strategy is foolhardy, as the new third district could very possibly be won by a strong centrist Republican in the general election.
We want to make sure these numbers keep going down, because we'd like very much to head into, you know, we have three holidays coming up, but especially Thanksgiving and Christmas, where people spend extended amounts of time together. So we'd like very much to get to a place where we can remove certain mask mandates.
Governor J.B. Pritzker with a hopeful projection regarding COVID. There's also one more week left in the state legislature's fall session, and still a lot on the plate, including redistricting. Also a confusing week with a court ruling and lawsuits. We heard from a witness at one hearing about redistricting. It was a citizen named Chris Keenish, who lives in Marie Newman's 3rd Congressional District. We'll discuss all that and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, emeritus professor and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. And Charlie's also been a longtime State House reporter and observer. Hannah Meisel is with us. She is NPR Illinois State House editor. And joining us today, Mark Maxwell, Capitol Bureau Chief for WCIA-TV. Mark, it's always good to have you with us.
It's always good to be here, Sean. Thanks for having me.
So, Mark, I'll go to you first. We had just seen some new congressional district maps drawn by Democrats last week, but now we had a court ruling this week affecting other maps, legislative maps. Quite a confusing mix there, but try to fill us in on what took place. Where do things stand right now when it comes to new legislative and congressional district boundaries?
The congressional district, we just saw the first draft, and Democrats are going to really show their hand here in the next several days. When they come back to town Tuesday through Thursday, we'll see the actual congressional district maps. There could be some changes or updates to the sort of draft version they floated earlier on. The federal court came out, and they're digging into the process of looking at these state house maps. These are your state representatives, state senators, and Republicans have challenged these maps. Latino groups have as well. You'll recall that the state passed those first preliminary maps without the full census data initially, just to check the box and control the process to make sure that Democrats drew the maps without any Republican input. Well, they came back in August and September and updated those with the full census data. Those are the better maps that actually match the population. The first maps were wildly off. Some of the districts were 20 to 25% variation in population. So the court said those maps are so bad, the first ones that you passed, we're going to strike those down once and for all, because Democrats didn't actually repeal them when they passed the updated maps. So the court just said, I think their language was, we want to make sure those first maps are in fact a dead letter. They won't rear their head again. Now let's start looking at the actual maps. Republicans sort of cheered this as a new inroad, or the court's quote seizing control of the process, but Democrats said this is how they always expected it to happen. I would point out, though, the courts did sort of slap the Democrats' hand a bit. They described their map-making scheme as a, quote, patchwork of political maneuvering and manipulation in passing that first sort of shell map back in May and then updating it with a new one. So the court wasn't too pleased with the scheme Democrats used, but so far they have not called it unconstitutional, not the new map they approved in September.
And Hannah, also legal action that's pending now regarding some other groups that aren't happy with what the Democrats have done.
Over the weekend, last weekend, the NAACP of the East St. Louis area and a couple of other groups that advocate for Black voting rights filed suit, specifically alleging that the districts that were drawn in the East St. Louis area, the House districts at least, would dilute the Black vote there. And, this also comes after a similar coalition of groups, though not exactly the same, had alleged you know, dilution of the Black vote in Chicago, also East St. Louis. And they had asked that the U.S. Department of Justice give that a look. They hadn't filed a formal lawsuit, though. You know, and so this, as Mark said, Republicans especially are taking this as a win, even though, of course, the court didn't actually do the one thing that they wanted, you know, the court to do, which would have been to force the reconstitution or the constitution of this bipartisan appointed commission that would have given Republicans 50-50 shot of controlling the process when it would eventually, you know, get to a dead end. And so what will happen next? Republicans and MALDEF, the Mexican American Legal Defense Education Fund, they're invited to draw their own maps and submit their own maps. And the court's basically saying, hey, you have to draw your maps so you can prove your claims against this second set of maps that Democrats passed in late summer and the governor signed last month. That does not mean that the court has taken over. Again, Republicans reading the tea leaves, getting excited about this small win, but it's definitely not a for sure win for them at all. Even if the court does take over, it's not like we would necessarily see massive shifts in what the Democrats passed. Often it's been kind of surgical in past decades. And, you know, that's, of course, just not a guarantee. It happens so infrequently. This is a different kind of suit, especially with the growth in the Latino population, not just in Illinois, but everywhere. But again, courts have just been, they're loath to intervene in this sort of thing. That's part of the reason they didn't want to say yes to constituting that bipartisan commission. It's the tone that was set by the Supreme Court a couple of years ago. They really don't want to get that much involved with a co-equal branch of government and intervene like that.
Yeah, Charlie, your thoughts on what's taken place and what you think may happen next.
Well, I think what's taken place was pretty predictable. The Republicans had this Hail Mary notion that, well, we can say because the court hasn't signed off on the map by the June 30th deadline in the Constitution, well, that means, therefore, that now that they've thrown out the, if they throw out the earlier map with, as Mark said, these wildly varying population differences, well, then we'll go to this commission that gives us a 50-50 chance of being able to do our own gerrymander. Well, the court, in its opinion, it took like three pages to do it, but it laid out, well, here's what the Constitution says. Here's what it means. It says that law has to be effective, and effective means it passed both houses, signed by the governor, and that's what really happened. It doesn't say that it has to clear all the court challenges, because if that were the rule, you'd never get a map, because these challenges are going to go on for months. And so that was a blow to the Republicans' hopes. As was mentioned in the ruling, the judges said that the Republicans have until November 8 to submit alternative map proposals. In other words, the Republicans who have not shown their hand thus far are now going to have to do it. And then the Democrats will have until November 18th to object or to respond. So the Republicans will submit a map. The Democrats will spend 10 days picking it to pieces. Then they'll come in and make changes to the maps that are currently the law. And what they'll do is they'll respond to the Hispanic complaints. They'll create maybe a couple of new Hispanic districts. They'll respond to the East St. Louis argument by reconfiguring the lines so that some of the Black population isn't peeled off to support neighboring districts with white majorities. In other words, they'll make changes that will be more than cosmetic, but they won't be so significant. The overall gerrymander favoring Democrats will be affected. And the courts actually have said, as Hannah mentioned, the Supreme Court ruled that gerrymandering is fine. And this court, despite complaining about the way the Democrats did it and how this was so partisan and all that, they conceded that, well, that's okay. And that's the expectation. I forget the exact language, but it was something along the lines that a political party does not need the same protections as a racial minority. So all in all, I'd say it was a total loss for the Republicans, and it was a partial win for the Democrats. And when all is said and done, it'll be a total win for the Democrats.
So basically, they've given them into November to present these their version of a map. What's going to happen after that? Will we see lawmakers come in, Hannah, just from a particular time frame?
First, of course, we have to get a final ruling from the courts. But you know, we have a time frame, because even though we pushed back the usually mid-March primary for Illinois to the end of June next year, you know, and that also pushes back the petition passing and the filing deadlines, that's still coming up relatively soon. And there's also a lot of like kind of behind the scenes work that has to be done to get ready for an election, things that the State Board of Elections has to do. So, you know, if somehow the legislature is ordered to, you know, make specific changes, I guess we would see, you know, some sort of emergency session being called. But, you know, first we have to get through these court challenges. And I would expect to see final decisions, you know, maybe late November. But we also, you know, we'll probably talk about the congressional map process in a second. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we expect to see probably some court challenges out of that too. And so those two things, they have to get done in relatively short order.
Well, I would say based on historical precedent, what will occur is that when this period for the Republicans to file their maps on the legislative districts and for the Democrats to respond, the court will make some ruling. And in the ruling, the court will adopt a map that will be in effect for the next election. And then it will be up to the General Assembly to codify it by passing a bill that probably just amending what's on the books now to reflect what the agreement was from the courts. But it won't require the legislature to act to finalize the decision by the court. And again, this is based on, you know, historic precedent going back 40 years.
And Mark, as far as the congressional district maps go, it's not likely to change the fact that we're going to see some vote on some version of that map next week, right?
Well, that's what the Senate president has committed to, and the members are basically in town. They took up a bunch of vetoes when they were in town in September, so this isn't really your traditional veto session. The big ticket item on the agenda during this fall session right now is the congressional map. There's a little bit of anxiety among some of the congressional Democrats, because they're not the ones with the pens in their hand. It's the state Democrats in Springfield who are drawing the maps. And there's been some infighting even about, you know, how involved should the governor's office be in this process. And the legislature is trying to keep their cards very close to their vest. The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, or the DCCC, has tried to make their efforts or their interests known. They want to protect their members. So what we're seeing right now is really an inter-party fight. There's very little chance that Republicans will have a chance to influence these maps at all. But I would say this, just looking at the maps that the Democrats put out, their first draft, a lot of people said, well, that's a 14-3 gerrymander. They're down to 17 seats, and Republicans are going to shrink their delegation from 5 down to 3. Well, that's true if you grade each of those districts on who elected President Trump and President Biden. It's a lot less true if you go back to 2018. That was the best year for Illinois Democrats on record. And in that year, Erica Harold won 6 of the 17 new districts that Democrats drew. So that tells you, if President Trump isn't on the ballot in 2022, which he won't be, Democrats are going to try to make him an issue. And Republicans can float candidates or put up candidates who are as competitive as Erica Harold was. Well, they might actually pick up seats. So there's no guarantee that in this new map that Democrats and their gerrymander is going to be effective. It still comes down to the election and the quality of the candidate.
To follow up on what Mark said, if on the other hand, you were to look at the results for Secretary of State when Jesse White ran, he probably won all 17 of those districts.
I think he won 16 of them. Yeah, I mean, that's the most electable candidate Illinois has ever seen.
It all depends on the quality of the candidate, because there've been, in the past, there've been people who've been elected from districts. I remember there was a district in the Rock Island area that elected a guy named Lane Evans, and Lane Evans had the worst record in Congress in terms of supporting President Reagan's agenda. Reagan was extremely popular in that district, but Evans would win. And I remember writing some of those contests for the Sun-Times, and I would talk to people and say, why are you for Lane Evans? Well, we don't really like the way he votes in Congress, but on the other hand, my grandma had a problem with Social Security and he fixed it for her.
The reason why people think that Erica Harold, Kwame Raoul election as a baseline is because that was an open seat. There were two new candidates, one Republican, one Democrat, that had not been elected statewide before. So there wasn't that power of the incumbency. There certainly wasn't the Jesse White factor. And Jesse White's opponent was a state's attorney who was chanting to lock Governor Pritzker up over mask mandates. Wasn't exactly a statewide candidate with statewide appeal. You know, if all things being equal, how do these districts like to vote, Democrat or Republican? And that kind of gives us a good barometer.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, along with Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and WCIA-TV's Mark Maxwell. Well, let's turn back to COVID and Governor making comments at the start of this show, Hannah, regarding the possibility of the mask mandate going away sometime soon. But the governor's got some other challenges still out there when it comes to getting certain people to take the vaccine, including many state workers.
As of, I think, the other day, the governor has now gotten 5 union agreements. These are the folks who work in congregate care facilities that the governor, way back in early August, said that he was going to be mandating vaccine for those people, because largely the folks who live in those places, prisons, state-run mental hospitals, veterans homes, developmental centers, they don't really have a choice of being there. And it's not them who are bringing in COVID to the facilities. It's the workers, for the most part. And I guess to a much more limited extent, you could argue visitors. But no, it's definitely workers who are bringing it in. And so that's, you know, his rationale for mandating the vaccine for those folks. But of course, AFSCME, the state's largest public employee union, who would cover, you know, 15,000 of these workers, they still have not agreed to, you know, a memorandum of understanding to kind of alter their collective bargaining agreement to allow for this mandate. And now the governor has had to push back his original October 4th first dose deadline twice. And the deadline is now approaching. It's supposed to be the 26th, and we'll see if AFSCME gets an agreement before then. But, you know, I think ABC7 in Chicago, they took a look at some state worker vaccine numbers this week, and I can't find the story right in front of me, but you know, it definitely varies widely. And in some places, the rates are pretty good, and others not so much. And AFSCME has been, you know, since the governor announced the mandate, they told their members, you know, don't worry about taking it. You don't have to do it right now. We will be fighting for you, et cetera, et cetera. And we've seen, as we've discussed on this program before, you know, some protests from workers in some of those facilities who they just really, for the most part, you're going to see a lot of people end up taking it, especially because the agreements that the governor's office has come to with these 5, you know, kind of labor units or 5 separate agreements that he's done so far, covering about 2,100 folks, they stipulate that if you do not agree and you don't qualify for a very narrow exemption, you know, you risk losing your job.
Yeah, and Mark, that's something that, I mean, nobody wants to see that happen, but the governor, he's in a tough position here. I mean, can he, you know, does he keep extending this over and over again? Certainly, these are, you know, what you would consider to be in many cases, you know, the type of workers that you wouldn't want to lose. So, I mean, because those positions need to be filled. So, I mean, the governor's in a tough spot here, it seems.
Well, and Illinois is a state that was already suffering from, you know, the pressures of seeing so many dramatic cuts over the years and a hollowed out state government. But I would point out this one difference. Washington State has implemented a very similar vaccine mandate with a testing alternative. They've fired 5,000 state employees in Washington just this week. 5,000. Illinois hasn't done that. And there's a very specific reason why. The Healthcare Right of Conscience Act, which was this law passed many years ago in Illinois, which was actually intended to provide some conscience cover to doctors or nurses who didn't want to participate in abortion. It includes this language in there that provides civil protection for people that refused to participate in medical testing or even vaccines, because there were some vaccines that have been developed with fetal tissue in some cases, and some people took a religious objection to this. So the state law right now has a very difficult thing for Governor Pritzker. What he wants to do is prevented by this civil protection that says, if you object to a vaccine or a test, which includes a COVID test, on any religious or medical objection, well, the law says you have that right. And the Pritzker administration says, look, people are abusing this. This was never intended to allow people to go into work sick and not tell their coworkers whether or not they have the coronavirus, a deadly virus. And so they're trying to find someone in the legislature who can be the champion for this bill. The problem is nobody can seem to agree on what the right language is to actually put this together. So without that Healthcare Right of Conscience Act being weakened to strengthen the state's vaccine or testing mandate powers, the governor might still be in this trick box with unions, and he'll have to slowly coax them into an agreement, because they can just push right back and say, you fire us, we're going to take you to court with discrimination lawsuits because the state law says you can't fire us for this.
Yeah, Charlie, that would be a tough vote, I think, for a lot of people to change that legislation regarding a healthcare right of conscience. It seems like that would be a difficult thing to try to get through the legislature.
Well, it depends on how narrowly it's drafted. For example, if it were to say this does not apply to situations involving vaccination for COVID, specifically write that into the language, then I think most lawmakers would have no problem voting for it. And let me rephrase it. It wouldn't be that hard to put together the 71 votes in the House, the 36 votes in the Senate needed to enact that law and make it effective immediately once the governor signs it. And that would clarify that. And Mark's right. When this was initially passed back in, I want to say it was maybe 78, 1978, the notion of having some pandemic was well in the rearview mirror. The Spanish flu epidemic of 1918 was not foremost in people's thoughts. And it, as Mark said, it had to do specifically with being involved with abortion or birth control. And the use of this to somehow say that, well, if you ask me to test, that's a kind of health care, and I object, I don't think that holds legal water. The legislature probably should clarify it next week and just clear it up and solve it once and for all.
Hannah, just about a minute left. If you can give us a quick update, there was a pretty big lawsuit filed this week by an attorney, Tom DeVore. His name has become well known. He's fought the governor's executive actions through the pandemic. Now he's filed a big suit against school districts.
That's right. DeVore has filed his probably biggest lawsuit so far of the last, you know, year and a half, naming 145 school districts across the state, in addition to the governor and, you know, his Illinois State Board of Education. You know, fighting both the mask mandate and, you know, the right for schools to quarantine kids without, you know, an order from the local health department. And, you know, this is just we'll see what happens. You know, DeVore really did have a losing, you know, record for most of the pandemic, but he has scored several wins in the last couple of months, wins that kind of have made the administration have to change gears or, adjust to those court orders, because it, as we've discussed, it might be that we're seeing the limits of his executive authority here. So we'll see what happens in this lawsuit. The governor obviously says he'll fight it. And then he also called DeVore a grifter, which then DeVore said, oh, he'll sue the governor for defamation, which you can't, because the governor, as governor, has immunity.
Time now for our notes from the field. And Mark, let's start with you.
Sure. A lot of people have been wondering, once we see these congressional maps, could a candidate like Rodney Davis run for governor? Right now, he's got a big Republican district that he would be housed in with no incumbent challenge on the Democratic side. So maybe he would just coast to re-election. But if we have any look at his political calculations that he's making, he voted against the interest of the January 6th committee this week in Congress in favor of protecting Steve Bannon from prosecution. This was a very controversial thing. There were 9 Republicans in the House, including Adam Kinzinger, who voted to recommend prosecution of Bannon for contempt of Congress and not complying with the subpoena. That's something Democrats would love to make a huge issue out of in a general election should Rodney Davis run for governor.
All right, Charlie.
Well, we're talking about Mark was just mentioning the gubernatorial election. We do know for a fact that the Libertarians have nominated their candidate. And it's a gentleman named Scott Schluter of Marion, who's a veteran and a mechanic. And he will not be a factor, hate to spoil it. The Libertarian candidate the last time around only got roughly 110,000 votes, or 2.5%. But the reason it's significant is because the Libertarians pointed out, we're going to have Mr. Schluter on the ticket with his running mate, and we're going to have to get 25,000 signatures to put them there. Whereas Pritzker and whoever the Republicans finally choose to run, be it Davis or somebody else, or the ones who are already declared, they only have to get 5,000. And in this stage of partisan bickering and acrimony, one thing that's been consistent over the years is that Democrats and Republicans both are in lockstep in making sure that the rules generally favor them and make it very difficult for third-party candidates to get on the ballot.
Okay. And Hannah?
Well, for the better part of 40 years, midwives have been fighting to get licensed in Illinois. Currently, there's only such a thing in Illinois as nurse midwives, which requires a nursing degree first. But, certainly midwives have been practicing illegally in Illinois, under the table, but people have been aware. But finally, after the House passed the licensure bill in the spring, the Senate took it up this week, near unanimous support. And I guess now it'll go to the governor.
That's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and Mark Maxwell, the Capitol Bureau Chief for WCIA-TV. Get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org through the NPR One app or iTunes, and join us next time. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.